This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we're delighted to have with us in the studio the great human rights lawyer, Michael Tiger.
Who will be able to follow up with on the challenges that movement lawyers face today?
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
Recently on Law and Disorder, we interviewed Bahir Azmi, the litigation director at the Center for Constitutional Rights, and we also interviewed National Lawyers Guild President Natasha Bannon. We were interested in their views of the challenges facing leftist lawyers and their movement clients in these difficult times. Today, we're joined in our New York studio by our guest, co-host, attorney Jim Lafferty, the former head of the Los Angeles chapter of the National Lawyers Guild, who has a program on our sister station in Los Angeles, KPFK. We're going to speak for the entire hour with human rights attorney Michael Tiger. Since 9/11, our democracy, however restricted at the time, has been even further shrunk by the growth of the national security state and the all-knowing surveillance apparatus that has been set up. Moreover, the president, as the head of the executive branch of the government, has gathered unto himself an unprecedented amount of power over the judicial and the legislative branches of our government. Michael Tiger is emeritus professor of law at Duke University and at the Washington College of Law. He's been a lawyer working on social change issues since the 1960s. He's argued numerous cases in the United States Supreme Court and many circuit courts of appeal. His books include Law and the Rise of Capitalism, Fighting Injustice, and the forthcoming Mythologies of the State and Monopoly Power. Michael Tiger, it's a great pleasure for Jim and I to welcome you to Law and Disorder.
Well, thank you very much. It's great to be here.
I want to start off by asking you a question. What is law? Martin Luther King's courageous attorney, Bill Kunstler, was given an award by the New York State Association of Criminal Defense Attorneys back in 1994, as was his classmate at Columbia, federal judge Jack Weinstein. And Kunstler spoke first, accepted the award on behalf of his clients. And then he said what he thought the judge believed what the law was. And Kunstler said he thought that the judge thought that law was the considered response of a civilized society to the problem of reaching a reasoned and intelligent conclusion to disputes between the state and its citizens or between the citizens themselves. And that's the liberals' view of the law. Then Kunstler said, but my view is different. And he told the audience that he thought that the law was, in fundamental essence, it's nothing more than a method of social control created by a socioeconomic system determined at all costs to perpetuate itself by all and any means necessary for as long as possible. Do you share this view?
Well, he's half right, but you can bat 500 and still lead the league. Of course, the law is a system of rules. In my book, Law and the Rise of Capitalism, I talked about legal ideology, which is erected as a superstructure on a system of social relations and is designed to protect and preserve that system of social relations. But then the next question is, how do they do it? They can have cops on every corner, and they can have repressive regimes, and they can crush you, or they can write something like the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, which is a set of promises the regime makes to the people about how there's going to be freedom and justice and so on, and just you wait and see. Don't make too much trouble because your so-called rights are protected. And what's happened is, of course, that the set of mythologies grow up. We have a department that calls itself justice when we know exactly what the hell it's doing. We have inadequate legal services, so people are pleading guilty and being hustled off to prison. But when you get a jury trial, when you get an Article III judge like Judge Weinstein who really cares about things, it's still possible to win these victories. And, you know, of all people in the world, at that stage of his career, Bill Kunstler knew that. because he spent his career as one of the most formidable advocates of the United States of America, defending people, keeping them out of jail, and all the rest of it. And you know what? If he really, in his heart of hearts, thought that that was complete bullshit, I don't think he'd have wasted his time. Now, then, with Judge Weinstein, it's nice to be able to characterize your opponent's position, as he does with Weinstein. Weinstein was not only very smart, but, you know, he was clever. And we took to him, as a matter of fact, in 1971. Many thousands of young men had gone outside the United States to escape the draft.
That's right.
And yet, when we looked at their selective service files, it turned out they were never going to be drafted anyway, because if they'd had good lawyers, they wouldn't have been called. They were eligible for deferments or whatever. Yeah. So we proposed to Weinstein, why don't you resurrect all these selective service files and start deciding these cases of these young men who have been indicted for draft refusal and have left the country? And Weinstein said, okay, I'll do that. And it was the Second Circuit kind of didn't agree, but this was one of the pressures that led then to the amnesty for the draft refusers. Mm-hmm. So I don't agree with Judge Weinstein all the time, but he understands what an Article III judge can do, because he says, hey, look, I'm not doing radical. I'm just making sure the regime keeps its promises to the people.
Speaking of judges, though, you had been editor-in-chief of your law review at the University of California, and that's an entree into some good jobs or some great clerkships. And you, in fact, became a clerk to Justice William Brennan, United States Supreme Court. But you only lasted a week. What happened?
I actually lasted less than a week. I
mean, okay.
I don't want to be. I was trying to be nice. I didn't even get the job. Well, Brennan appointed me as his clerk at the end of my second year in law school to take up the job when I graduated. Yeah. The word got out, and all hell broke loose. James Kilpatrick of the Richmond News Leader wrote an editorial called The Lady and the Tiger. A member of the House Committee on Un-American Activities attacked the court. Ramsey Clark got the FBI involved in providing information to Brennan about my so-called political background. And at that time, Ronald Reagan was running for governor of California. Mm-hmm. Brennan walks into chambers one day and looks at his law clerk from the previous term, Owen Fisk, as he's ashen. And he says, the chief told me to fire Tiger. That's Warren. Mm-hmm. And Warren's theory was that this guy could lead, maybe Ronald Reagan would become governor of California, which, by the way, he was going to get unless he'd been found in a motel with a male chicken.
That's but, about it.
Yes. So Brennan got upset. And we had a meeting. I flew back to Washington. We talked about it. And he told me some of the things that the FBI reports have been sent to him, much of which was bullshit. I took the position that I was not going to make a public statement about my politics, and I wouldn't authorize him to make one either. We're not going to be sanitizing me. I would disclose to him anything that he wanted. And he accepted that idea. I got back to Washington, and he had changed his mind, and he withdrew the invitation to be his clerk. And there it was. I got a job with Edward Bennett Williams. Mm-hmm. It was unusual. I argued, I'd argued three cases up there by 1977. And Brennan wrote to me and asked me to come and have lunch with him. And I did. And his first thing out of his mind was, you don't know how much trouble I had getting Byron White to be the fifth vote for you in that Gelbard case. You know. So that was nice. And we talked back and forth, and we then started to meet every once in a while. I worked with him on some speeches he wanted to make. We talked. He then wrote to me and apologized.
Finally apologized, yeah.
Said, I've overreacted. I'm sorry. The only thing that helps me live with myself is that we have become good friends.
Mm-hmm.
And it's amazing. The last time I ever saw him, I was in chambers, and we were walking out of his chambers into his office. He grabbed me by the arm, and he said, have I done any good up here?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Which goes back to Michael Stephen Smith's first question,
yeah.
Right? Have I done any good up here?
That's right.
So, yes, that is the Brennan story.
All right.
The bright side is that as you know, I became famous as the guy that was appointed to be a Supreme Court clerk, but I never had to read any cert petitions.
That's right.
I didn't have to do the work.
But it was on your resume.
Yes.
Sort of.
Yeah.
Michael, in your book, Law and the Rise of Capitalism, you propose what you call an insurgent role for lawyers. Talk about what this means, please.
I use the term jurisprudence of insurgency, and that is the same thing with which we started today. There are open spaces in the law There are promises the regime has made to the people that it feels obliged to keep. And so what Bill Kunstler did for all those years, and what I hope, you know, what a bunch of other of us do, is we represent people and call on the state to keep those promises. But as time goes by, it becomes clear that the state is not keeping these promises, that pandemic racism still dominates events, that we can manage to get some person in the White House who systematically commits a series of crimes and so far at least is not accountable for them, and so on. And that is the point at which the lawyer has to say to the clients, because it's all about the clients, as you pointed out with your first question, I'm sorry that the struggle we're doing we will keep on with, but I really am not going to overpromise about what is going to happen. That's the jurisprudence of insurgency. When I was in South Africa in 88, 89, you could see that. The African National Congress conducted a two-part struggle. It had many, many lawyers who showed up and represented ANC members and sympathizers. And at the same time, it had an armed struggle that went on over the years. And the interesting things, I know it's a long answer, 1989, I'm sitting with Dulla Omar, who was Mandela's lawyer, later became Minister of Justice. And we were over there, Ken Brown, Jim Ferguson, and I, training young lawyers. And he said, tomorrow I wanted you to teach these lawyers how to cross-examine cops. And I said, okay, I can do that. And he, I mean at demonstrations, he said, because what we're going to do this summer, we have a new organization, we're going to have wait-ins, sit-ins, walk-ins, and so on. People of color are a majority in this country. We're going to bring the place to a halt, and nobody's going to plead guilty. They're all going to be mass arrests, and we're going to cross-examine every cop, we're going to try every case, and Mandela's coming out. And I said, Dulla, this bullshit. I've seen the dogs, I've seen the guns, I've seen the whole thing. He said, no, he's coming out. We're gonna just show our power in this way and bring the system to a halt. And as you know, Mandela got out.
He got out. He was right.
He was right. And that is, but that's the sort of interplay of an understanding of the laws of motion of a social system and its legal ideology and the prospect of change.
If a law student came to you today, asked you for some counseling, said, look, Professor Tiger, I understand Karl Marx studied law. Fidel Castro and Lenin were both lawyers for a short time, but then they joined socialist activist organizations. I'm wondering what I should do. I'm a socialist as a young law student here, and should I be getting out of law school and getting into one of these socialist organizations, or should I stick it out in law school and practice law? I mean, I feel now conflicted.
Well, the first thing that I would say is you ought to learn your craft. That is to say, learn what they got for you, because you'll never be able to replicate that experience. You've got clinical legal education opportunities actually to learn how to, you know, relate with clients and to deal with their concerns. Because I tell you something, as I wrote in a play once, had a character say, you lawyers imagine you stand at the center of all the events by which the world is moved. But which, of course, is not true. You stand where you stand when you stand because some client is a victim of injustice. But that's the definition of a trial lawyer, is a massive blob of ego suspended yes. over a chasm of insecurity. But what I would tell this lawyer is, well, you know, you got some options. One thing is, you could be a professor and write books and be influential. You could sort of emulate the young Karl Marx, whose iconic essays on the law relating to the theft of wood and the property norms still resonate. Or you could be a trial lawyer, because you might think the law is bullshit, and maybe it is, but when some client calls you from the jail and says, could you come down and get me out, that puts a kind of obligations on you to get that job done and maybe try that case to a jury or make a deal.
And that might be a political activist of great importance at the moment.
And the third thing you can do is you can become involved in human rights litigation.
That's right.
Because they're still doing it. And now, and at the risk of wasting your time, I'll tell you a story. 40 years ago, Orlando Letelier and Ronnie Moffat were assassinated in Washington, D.C. at Sheridan Circle by agents of the Chilean secret police, the DINA. The actual assassin was Michael Vernon Townley, a joint citizen of Chile and the United States. He gets put in the witness protection program and is still being run as an intelligence agent to this good day. We get a judgment against Chile for Isabel, the widow, and her sons, and we collect it, $4 million. Well, Townley also killed somebody else. In 1973, during the coup, he killed a Spanish diplomat named Carmelo Soria in Santiago. So my students at Human Rights Clinic that Jane and I, and we run, we sued Townley for killing Carmelo Soria in Santiago, and we get a default judgment against him. Now, the widow of Carmelo, Gloria Gonzalez Vera, starts a lawsuit in Chile saying, I want Chile to extradite Townley out of the United States, get him back here, and try him. Well, I went down and I appear before a single justice of the Chilean Supreme Court. And he says, no, senor, he said, I'm very sorry, but the amnesty that Pinochet granted to his people extends to Townley, and we can't try him for murder here because he got amnesty. So we went downstairs, and we did law student stuff. I said to my students, I said, you know something? The Chilean Penal Code has a different crime called illicit association. It's not conspiracy. It's the commission of substantive offenses while a member of an illicit group. The Townley worked with a group of people who carried out these terrible things. So we go to the en banc Chilean Supreme Court, all the justices, and take a daring position. And the Chilean Supreme Court for the first time holds that the entire Pinochet secret police apparatus was an illicit association and opens the door to prosecuting and civil suits in Chile, where the situation is. So what? And you know what? It was law students from Washington College of Law who did the research and met with Laura Gonzalez Vera and worked with these human rights lawyers and so on. So what would I tell him? I'd say that young person, I'd say, well, you know, there's still work to do. Me, I'm kind of getting too old for this. You know, I'm like the dog on the porch that used to bark at cars. Yeah, I bark at injustice as
and
it grows past. Yes,
and
right.
Ran. Then you start just barking.
I just bark. No, that's it.
I'm reminded of what Hillary Clinton said about her husband. It's hard to keep that dog on the porch.
Yeah, that's right.
We're speaking with attorney Michael Tiger. Michael, we're you, me, and Jim all around the same age. We're all 60s radicals. You were active in the anti-Vietnam War movement in Berkeley, California, when you were a student at the University of California. Jim and I were active in the anti-war movement in Detroit. I wanted to ask you about the challenges that we face today as compared to back then, 50 years ago. We were able to lend a hand. Of course, it was the Vietnamese that really did it, but we were able to lend a hand in stopping American aggression against Vietnam. We were able to lend a hand in the impeachment of Richard Nixon. And now we're embroiled in the forever war. Looks like Trump is likely to not be impeached, although I'm not sure. But how would you compare the period back then when we were young and active and the period now?
In the Vietnam War period, we had, it's funny to say this, the advantage that millions of young men felt the pressure of the draft.
That's right.
Now, that was both a blessing and not a blessing. Because some of them thought that if you just oppose the draft, as opposed to looking at imperialism and its manifestations, the broader look, that you'd done enough. But the fact is that the resistance to the draft, the wholesale resistance to the draft, was a major factor. And indeed, talking about the legal thing, first case I ever argued in the Supreme Court of the United States was 1969. I was 28 years old. And the Selective Service System, if you tore up your draft card, they classified you as delinquent and immediately accelerated you for induction. 3,000 young men had gone to jail on that basis. And the Supreme Court held unanimously that was illegal, and those 3,000 young men got out. How the court changed its view over a couple of terms, I don't know. But those were the days. What's going on today? What we're seeing is, I think, a very impressive civil rights movement around the issue of racism, because that racism is a major, you know, pandemic, major issue, and the attitude of this administration towards the far right and the fascists is a big deal. That's the most hopeful sign here. whether Trump's going to be impeached or not, I don't know. I don't think we can always, we shouldn't put our faith in the government to solve our problems for us. In addition to that, these promises that are being made about bringing jobs back to the United States and so forth and so on, okay, we're seeing some bump in the unemployment figures that looks good. But the fact is that this wholesale business of globalization, outsourcing, and so on is going to come back to bite the administration in the ass, just as it did the Democrats for supporting all of these things that permitted exporting jobs to other countries.
And even those unemployment figures, I mean, people are taking 2-3 jobs to survive, giving no medical benefits, no guaranteed hours. I mean, it's a high unemployment of poverty-level jobs in many cases.
Yes, and these are unorganized workers working on subsistence wages.
Absolutely. I think, following up, you mentioned the Mueller investigation. I wanted to ask you about that. The speculation that Trump obstructed justice, laundered money, collaborated with the Russians and what have you. There's so much. It hasn't been going on as long as the Watergate investigation did, and yet there's calls, of course, and demands that it be ended and so forth and so on. Just this last week, he yelled at Sessions again to get that thing over with. What's your overall, I asked this question in the spirit of you, say whatever you want to say about this Mueller investigation and what's going on around it today, the role of the Republicans, the Democrats, whatever you want to talk about that has to do with that, I would be interested in hearing, and I think our audience would.
The Republican majority in the House of Representatives and the Senate is spineless, and they go along with anything. Yeah. Mueller is an experienced federal prosecutor. He has assembled a staff of experienced and very savvy federal prosecutors, including Michael Dreeben, who was the Deputy Solicitor General of the United States. I've known Michael for 40 years. And so you can count on them doing a workmanlike job. Where this leads, I don't know. It is clear that Trump did obstruct justice. The Comey firing and his confession about it is just one indication. And Alan Dershowitz's attempt to defend that conduct as not being a violation of the law is just, quite frankly, horrible. Whether or not Mueller will get that far, I don't know. Because the fact is that this White House and the people connected to it are a bunch of the most corrupt folks that you could conceivably imagine, exploiting their political positions for financial gain and all the rest of it. So, you know, we shall see. That's all I can say.
I agree.
The point is, we in the movement for change, we who want change, have to recognize that if it happens, it'll happen because large numbers of people in motion get busy and make it.
I wanted to continue along those lines with respect to the power of the executive. Even at the time of the founding of our country and the writing of the Constitution, there was a fear that the executive branch of the government would be too powerful because the president controlled the military. Are the powers of the executive larger now than they were in the 60s? And conversely, has the power of the legislative branch of the government been diminished?
I could go on for 2 hours, but I won't. Your concern about what the Founding Fathers thought is exactly right. Patrick Henry opposed adoption of the Constitution because he said, if your chief executive be a man of address and he comes at the head of his army, will Mr. Chief Justice make him give bail? So he understood the problem. And John Marshall, our first Chief Justice, understood it as well. Marshall, in Marbury versus Madison, wrote that all citizens who are the victim of government misconduct should have a remedy in the courts, and that if they weren't going to get one, then there could only be few and narrow circumstances that would justify denying it. Then he went on, sitting as trial judge in the Aaron Burr case, to say that Jefferson himself, the President of the United States himself, would be answerable to a subpoena. So Marshall didn't have any doubt about that. And that's one of the wonderful chapters of American history. Mm-hmm. Jefferson hated Marshall. Marshall hated Jefferson. They both said terrible things about one another, in part because Marshall had been appointed Chief Justice at the very last gasp of the Adams administration, disappointing Jefferson's hope to have Spencer Roane become Chief Justice. But enough of that. So we have the Supreme Court saying in 1803 in Marbury and then in the Burr case, yes, we will control the executive branch. Right? And then it turned out that the court retreated from that obligation. It first began by excluding Native Americans from the reach of the judicial power. They're not people. And then, of course, in Dred Scott, African Americans aren't people either. A case that, by the way, Chief Justice Greer told President Buchanan, President-elect Buchanan, we're about to decide a case and it's going to solve the slavery problem. And Buchanan mentioned that in his inaugural address. Well, that was Dred Scott. It didn't solve it at all. So that was at first staking out this high ground and then the disappointment. Read the summer 2014 issue, A Monthly Review. You can get it online. I've written an article about that in Law and the Rise of Capitalism, second edition. There's more. But let's fast forward to your concern. Here we get this massive surveillance. And the first thing about we know about it is that it is everything. They're collecting everything. Second thing we know about it is it's secret. Right? This is a secret process. You can't even know what they're doing. But what we do know they're doing is they're sneaking some of that information off to law enforcement people who are using it to prosecute folks and to make untraceable the illegal sources of the information. Second, they're using it to program drone strikes, which have killed thousands of civilians, despite their claims about accuracy. So that's the first thing that happens is that's what they're doing. Now, the second thing that happens is that the judicial branch does not step up to the task. This is one of these times when we reach the end point. Does not step up to the task of providing any redress. The judicial branch accepts the state secrets privilege, which is not like the lawyer-client privilege. That protects your privacy. The state secret privilege counterposes the state to the interest of the citizens in knowing what's going on. And so you have a drone strike that kills an American citizen who is targeted.
Targeted.
And that person is told, that family is told, first, we can't even discuss this in court because the whole thing is secret. And the second thing is, well, it's a political question and the courts really can't address it. So the judiciary abdicates in the face of claims by the executive branch of that the courts have no business. Now, Is there a remedy? Well, there are international tribunals that can have something to say about this and can have some influence on events. Not perhaps with respect to this massive surveillance, but the International Court of Justice is just now, just in September, going to deal with a case that involves the fate of the Diego Garcia military base and the fact that the United Kingdom should never have been able to keep the island of Diego Garcia from becoming part of Mauritius when Mauritius got to be independent. So, and that international tribunal decision may have some effect. I have testified before the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights about inadequate assistance of counsel given to a young African-American man. The United States doesn't accept a compulsory jurisdiction, but it still can have some influence on how these things work. But the fact is that the government regards itself as unaccountable.
Yeah.
To come back to your question, with respect to these fundamental questions of national security, the government regards itself as unaccountable. In the Lynn Stewart case, and you know Lynn very well, in the Lynn Stewart case, there were secret wiretaps. And the judge said, well, I'm going to examine these things in camera. And I looked at the regulations under which he's examining them. The FBI got to decide which law clerks would be entitled to look at the papers that the judge was looking at. I said, Your Honor, this is nuts. You're an Article III judge, and you're going to let the FBI choose your law clerks? I said, I personally have had some experience with how law clerks get chosen. I don't know if you read about that or not, but the fact is it's a disgrace.
But the judge was unmoved.
Yes, unmoved, yes.
And the separation, going beyond separation of powers questions, from supposedly co-equal branches of government, there's been a lot written in recent times, since the Patriot Act in particular, in my mind, of how many of the first 10 amendments, that Bill of Rights, have been eroded within the last 15, 16, 17 years. Is that your impression? If so, talk about that a bit, or if not, tell me
gosh.
I'm full of it.
Well, let's start with Amendment Number 1,
yeah.
Freedom of Speech. Not so much eroded, as subjected to a pervasive mythology that renders it of much less effective than you would have thought. I have a book coming out in September, Mythologies of State and Monopoly Power. And I begin one chapter by saying, I walked down to the marketplace of ideas the other day, but they didn't have anything I wanted. And I went over to the side. There were some actual people who had some ideas. They were trying to pass out leaflets, but the cops were running them off. So the fact is that it used to be that you could stand on the street corner and pass out leaflets. It used to be if you wanted to organize a union, you could get into the plant. Supreme Court said no. It goes to a shopping center, sorry, that's private property. It looks like a city. It's portrayed as a city. It's a simulacrum of a city. It's a gathering place. But I'm sorry, you got to stand next to the freeway and pass out your leaflets. We get a case like Citizens United. A perfectly good Supreme Court justice like Anthony Kennedy decides that corporations have First Amendment rights. Now, the Supreme Court, when it held that corporations could be criminally liable, pointed out that corporations have enormous power that transcends that of any private individual. But so why would you equate the right of the individual handbiller to that? We already talked about that. Yeah. Then, back in the day, we had a thing called the Fairness Doctrine. Why? Because the ether, the broadcast spectrum, that's up there in the sky. Nobody can own it. It is a limited resource. But broadcasters said, no. We own the actual radio station, the hardware. And that must mean that we are the ones that communicate. And thus, the Supreme Court's decision, the famous Red Lion case, is no more. I don't know if you remember that case. Fred Cook, who was a great investigative journalist, was attacked by Billy James Hargis, Reverend Billy James Hargis. Cook demanded the right of reply, and the station said no. Supreme Court upheld the Fairness Doctrine and said he had the right of reply. Then that was a great case, because Hargis then got into trouble because of financial and sexual peccadilloes. It is said that he had sex with both the bride and the groom on the wedding night after he performed the ceremony, but we don't know if they each got equal time.
That doctrine may not have applied.
Yeah, right.
We're speaking with attorney Michael Tiger. Michael, you've got a book that's about to come out. Would you mention the title of it again and tell our audience, because I think they can pre-order it, and I think they'd like to do that. What's the name of the book?
It's called Mythologies of State and Monopoly Power.
And Monthly Review
is putting it out. You can also get it on Amazon, or you can go to monthlyreview.org and pre-order it. The great thing is, I, some years ago, became fascinated with the work of Roland Barthes, Barthes, a French writer, semioticist, and so on, who had published a book called Mythologies, in French mythology, including some things about the so-called justice system. And I admired that form. What Barthes taught us is that there are these mythologies that surround the action of power wielders to try to make us believe that it's okay what's going on. I start the book by noting that as the guillotine blade descended in old France, the executioner would cry, "In the name of the French people, justice is done. Au nom du peuple français, justice est faite." Well, no, it wasn't. All that meant was the state had appropriated to itself the right to define the term called justice, mm-hmm. Right? And then we look back at worker rights. You were talking a moment ago. Mm-hmm. Now, it was as 1721, we're getting labor organizations for the first time in England. And the organization members are prosecuted for conspiracy and restraint of trade because the judge pointed out it's all right for one individual worker to try to get his or her wages raised, but when they join together, they are conspiring in restraint of trade. The idea that labor organization was a conspiracy in restraint of trade survived well into the 20th century, which is to say the right to bargain about things is an individual right and not a social right. And
aren't we moving in that direction again?
Well, we are, absolutely. Now that the right to strike exists and the right to organize exists, what we're finding in low-wage industry is pretty significant. In Smithfield Foods down in North Carolina, which is where I now live, and then the Service Employees Union. But let's take Service Employees Union.
Yep.
That is a labor organization that actively seeks to organize people in marginalized situations. The hospital used to launder their own sheets. Now they send it all downtown where low-wage workers launder them. And so Service Employees Union, Teamsters Union, and farm workers have organized a group called Change to Win.
That's right.
So what happens? An employer subject to a Change to Win campaign sues under the racketeering statute, saying that it's an extortion. That what's happening is the unions are attempting to extort money from the employer by forcing the employer to pay more for workers' wages than they want to pay. Now, of course, Smithfield Foods has to bargain with all manner of people about, you know, the toilet soap and the toilet paper, and but the workers try to do it to extortion. Those suits have not succeeded. Not a single one has succeeded. But they have succeeded in this way. They've sued the Service Employees Union, Cintas, the Food Workers Union, the Hospital Workers Union, all, and those suits are very expensive to defend.
Yeah.
So they're bleeding the organizations dry,
yeah.
Attempt to bleed the organizations dry by making them litigate these claims.
Yeah.
So once again, for free bargain and hard-nosed bargaining is okay until the workers show up and want to do something.
Let's talk about the Supreme Court. Now that Justice Kennedy is leaving, and it looks like his chosen replacement, Brett Kavanaugh, is going to step up to the job, I wanted to get your feelings about what we now have as at least a 5-4 hard right majority on the Supreme Court. What kind of cases do you think are coming up before them, and how do you think they might decide these cases? There was the originalist doctrine that Judge Scalia propounded. There was the other doctrine Roberts said he only calls balls and strikes, doesn't make the law. What do you think the Supreme Court now is all about?
In the first place, the idea that the Supreme Court justices are simply umpires calling balls and strikes is bull. We can say bull on this thing.
I mean, you can say and, bull, but not.
Okay. So bull, and they'll yes. Well, it's nonsense,
and
it's been nonsense ever since at least the Adams administration, because the Adams administration understood that you had to control the judiciary. That's why they passed the Midnight Judges Act. That's how we got John Marshall as Chief Justice. So anybody that reads American history knows that that's just nonsense, and John Roberts doesn't believe it either.
Yeah.
Now, with respect to originalism, you know, that too is a fiction, because we cannot know the mindset of those folks. And even if some of the hints that we have about them, that is to say they own slaves, and that they thought that white men of property were the only people eligible to jury service, and all the rest of that stuff that was regarded as the way things were at the time the Constitution was adopted, we simply don't accept anymore.
And even if, excuse me, interrupt you, but here's what's always fascinating me, and I want you to talk. Even when people point to the Federalist Papers, they quote it with great authority or this or that as part of their originalist idea, that's an interpretation. They're still making an interpretation.
Well, and Madison himself said, who knows what future generations will
make of
the words that we have written.
Exactly.
So, and that too, that, by the way, is originalist.
Yeah.
And it was Madison, by the way, who also warned about the excesses of the executive branch, saying that, you know, we hope that we have rejected the impious doctrine of the old world that people are made for kings and not kings for people. So originalism is silly. And if you want to read something interesting, Judge Posner, who just retired from the Seventh Circuit, reviewed Scalia and Garner's book on textual and originalist consideration in the New Republic. Yeah, that's enough of it. You can get it for a Google search, which he completely eviscerated this nonsensical view of things. Originalism, textualism, is simply a cover for an agenda that folks have. And everybody knows about that. I think Justice Kennedy himself, although he said from time to time he would say he was an originalist, nonetheless wrote leading opinions on the right of gay marriage and all the rest of it. He wasn't really an originalist.
But the other thing, though, that concerns me is people often talk about his swing vote, and he certainly was in some critical cases. But his overall record was still conservative. The court has gotten more and more conservative in terms of workers' rights, more and more a corporatist court, right?
Absolutely. And one more thing about originalism. You know, during the debate, during the oral argument in Obergefell versus Hodges, the gay marriage case, Scalia asks Ted Olson, who's arguing for the petitioners, when did this gay marriage become a constitutional right? When exactly did that arise? Was it 1787? And Olson didn't have, he thought, well, that wasn't a question that required an answer. But that question reveals something. What do you mean, when? When did separate schools become unconstitutional? Was it 1954 when the Supreme Court decided Brown? No. Racial segregation is, has always, within, to the memory, to the point where the memory of man runneth not. You know, racism has always been bad.
Yeah.
The fact the Supreme Court didn't wake up to it until 1954 didn't mean that that's only when it started being bad. That, too, is an insight into interpretation. Mm-hmm. And then, now to your question. The court, of course, yes, the court is corporate. They've tried to curb the power of unions, again, with this phony First Amendment argument.
Yeah.
And it becomes a challenge. So we ask ourselves, you go up there are nine justices. You ask yourself, how do I get five votes? With Roberts, what kinds of issues am I likely to be able to get a vote? On the right to counsel in criminal cases, he's written some interesting things. Okay, so if we've got that case, that's the one to whom we're speaking. And, you know, with Scalia, he came on the bench, he'd already made up his mind. There was no sense talking to him. All he wanted to do was interrupt your argument and be rude to you. So we're in a bad spot.
Yeah.
What can I say?
Yeah, no.
But I want to remind you, apartheid shut down the black vote in South Africa in 1953. For 30 years, those lawyers went to court every day and defended people.
That's right.
They kept the faith and kept up the struggle.
And it's also worth noting, isn't it, in that same regard, that all-male Supreme Court that thought a woman had no right to choose didn't simply wake up one morning and say, geez, we've been schmucks. Of course she has a right to choose. Hundreds of thousands of people over and over again marched in the streets, went to jail, made it. So that politics that we talk about suddenly began to turn the other way on the court, didn't it?
Oh, well, you can see that in a number of instances.
Sure.
One of my favorites is, after the civil rights movement became tired of suing one school district one grade at a time, 1960, February 1st, the sit-in movement begins in Greensboro, and then the direct action movement.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, the lawyer's role is transformed into representing folks in criminal courts. And whoops, the world changes. And in 1969, no, it's before then, because Jack Kennedy was still president. Early 1963, I think, and you can check me on this, the first wave of sit-in cases reaches the Supreme Court. And Solicitor General Cox files an amicus brief pointing out how the Jim Crow system was installed in the South and so on. The court writes an opinion that basically exonerates, finally gets around to writing an opinion, late in 64 after the Civil Rights Act of 64 has passed, exonerates that whole batch of people that had sat in. The thousands of young people that had put their bodies on the line.
That's right.
About civil rights, the court said, look, we could go through this case by case. We could look at this. But no, tell you what, the passage of the Civil Rights Act abates all those prosecutions, reset the clock to zero, start over again. Same thing, I think, with that selective service case that I talked about. Hey, one of the things I learned sitting in a law office in Washington, D.C., was that people who were ordinarily very conservative, either they or their friends had young men who were subject to the draft. And, it's like being told you're going to be hanged in the morning. It just clarifies your vision.
It does.
We're speaking with Attorney Michael Tiger. Michael, the far right, led by the Koch brothers and their network of billionaires, are very strategic. Since 2010, they've elected 700 people to state legislatures. ultimately, they would like a constitutional amendment coming out of a constitutional convention under Article 5, which would allow for two-thirds of the states to call a convention and amend the Constitution with two-thirds of the states voting for it. And there are some other things, but they could get over that and they could amend our Constitution. This was done by the military dictator Pinochet in Chile, about whom you've spoken, and I know you're familiar with him. They altered the Constitution in Chile in such a way as to almost permanently preserve the property rights of the ultra-rich in that country. Do you see that there's a danger of this happening here in the United States?
Absolutely. I think that the danger of, let's call it fascism, because that's what it is, and the danger that the rich folks like the Koch brothers, or however you pronounce it, taking charge of the political process through the unlimited supply of money that the Supreme Court now holds they can pump into the process, creates this real and present danger. So yes, that exists. So then the question is, what should we do about it? Now, Chile at the time of the Pinochet coup had a strong left tradition, and that those folks mobilized and eventually succeeded in pushing him from office. And because of the work I did with some other people, I got to see some of that. So the question is, yes, these are the dangers. This is what these folks want to do. What should we do about it? And what we should do about it is don't mourn, organize. Everybody in their own community has the opportunity to do something. You, the two people to whom I'm speaking, do something. You do this radio program. I happen to live in North Carolina. My wife calls our two senators every other day and points out that how can you apologize and be an apologist for and not stand up to a man who violates every conservative traditional value that you purport to uphold? I am amazed at the number of law students in law schools who want to get involved in doing human rights clinical work and provide representation to the unrepresented. I mean, hey, if you're in a law school and you're listening to me right now, go look up the clinical programs and see what you can do. And if they don't have one, then go to the local prisoner's rights office and people's law office and all the rest of it and ask your professors if you can get course credit for going and working there. So we each do what we can, and we recognize that the three of us that are around here, gee, I don't know how old we all are, but I don't think we're going to see how this ultimately plays out. We just keep doing what we can.
Yes, you can. The Center for Constitutional Rights, President Jules LaBelle, wrote a significant book, Success Without Victory. And in it, he says, the law generally is designed to maintain the status quo and maintain state power. But it is a tension, particularly in modern capitalism. The power is maintained through the use of laws that can be used by the oppressed to challenge that power. The key task for social movement lawyers, therefore, is to empower people to help build movements and to challenge in fundamental ways how state power is used. I assume you agree with that, but how might lawyers do that today? Is it any different doing it today than it was when you started doing it so many, many, many years ago?
Well,
and if so, how?
Well, yes and no. We try cases the same way that Abe Lincoln tried cases.
Sure.
We cross-examine snitches. We cross-examine cops. We ask the court to provide us information that we say that the other side is withholding. These are the basic techniques that we use. Second, we recur, as Jules LaBelle says, to the fundamental principles about what I've characterized as the promises the regime makes to the people. The law books are full of cases in which you can cite to the Supreme Court to this good day, pointing out that the court has a job to do and ought to get busy and do it. They're also full of horrible cases. Indeed, it was some of those horrible cases in the McCarthy period that led me to want to go to law school. Any law student listening should pick out volume 367 of the United States Reports and start reading at 367 U.S. 1 and read for about 300 pages. And if you're not thoroughly depressed, then reading all this McCarthyite that got McCarthyite stuff that got, you know, five justices
right.
on board, that, I mean, that's what led me to the law. This is our job. We are fulfilling the same role that great advocates in the tradition of the United States and other countries, but mostly in our country,
is it tougher, though? Is it tougher today to be that movement lawyer than it was then? Or is it different in some ways, if not tougher? I'm thinking, I suppose, of the sophistication of the surveillance.
It is hard to convince judges.
Yeah.
To penetrate the wall of secrecy and surveillance.
That's right.
But learning your craft and being, you know, keeping on the track is there. But also, there are fewer barriers to entry to being an effective lawyer than there were 50 years ago. That is to say, 50 years ago, you wanted to start a law office, you had to have books. You had to have space for the books. You needed all kinds of paralegal secretarial help and so on. These days, for $800 from Best Buy or wherever the heck it is, you can buy a computer and a printer, and you get a low-cost subscription to some online legal services, and any bar associations have cheapo ones that are included in your dues, like the D.C. Bar does. And now, with a ream of paper, you're in business. In terms of barriers to entry and in terms of the cost of maintaining your office, it's less. Right? The second thing is that you begin to start exploring fee-shifting arrangements like the Equal Access to Justice Act if you begin doing civil cases, getting appointed to represent the people in criminal cases and arguing for continuing to raise the hourly rate and the number of hours for which you can bill. That, by the way, is difficult. There's a judge out in the Eighth Circuit that kept denying. He said, listen, I am not going to allow you to pay for running down there and visiting your client in the jail. Have him come to your office. And it was pointed out that these were capital cases, and it was very unlikely that the client was going to be able to come to your office.
As he might wish to.
I get that now. Sometimes it's like trying to explain a sundial to a bat, but you can succeed. So, yes, there is opportunity. It's a different form of legal organization. Second, for you at the top of the class who have these aspirations, major law firms are much more conscious of the need to do pro bono work. And, for example, a year ago, Erdogan's thugs beat up some Kurdish demonstrators in Washington. Well, we've got two law firms working with law students at Washington College of Law. We're suing Turkey and the actual goons, but law firms are putting their young associates on that to learn about this and to participate in the process because it makes them better lawyers. So the answer could go on and on, but the message is clear. Nobody has an excuse to sit on the sidelines and bemoan the lack of opportunity to get involved.
That's right.
Attorney Michael Tiger, we're coming to the end of our allotted time, but I don't want to let you go without asking
you mean the
two
allotted
things.
Time for this interview. You're not...
yes, we hope it's not.
No, we're not checking out...
don't say things like that with guys our age. You got to be very careful now with that.
Mention again the book that you got coming out. We want to have you back next month to talk about the book in detail, but I want people to know that it's in the pipeline and they can reserve a copy.
It's Mythologies of State and Monopoly Power. You can reserve it on Amazon.com or at monthlyreview.org. Also, we've been talking about jurisprudence of insurgency, the role of lawyers, law and the rise of capitalism. That was a fun book to write, and...
That was a great book to read. I reviewed it at the time. I've got a new book coming out myself, and I'm including that review. Michael, how can people keep up with your work?
How can Michael keep up with his work?
Well, we're talking about... I wanted to mention your blog site.
I know.
Yes, well, I do have a blog called Tiger Bytes, TigarBytes, and whatever else, Blogspot. I don't know how this works. I just log on and do it. I don't post all the time. but every once in a while I'll get on and react to something. So there are a lot of essays on there that people might find interesting.
I do. They're an absolute delight. Jim, did you want to say anything?
No, just I said to Mike, you don't need me for this, but I'm so glad he invited me because I wouldn't have gotten a chance to see you.
Thank you very much.
It's been a real pleasure, Michael Tiger, and we'll talk to you again next month. You take it easy.
Thank you. Hey.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.